What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
A couple of years ago, I went to visit my brother in Palo Alto, California. He rents a little cream-colored stucco house. And for the privilege of two small bedrooms, one tiny bathroom, and a galley kitchen, his family pays more than $5,000 a month. It still makes my heart stop a little bit saying that number. But, you know, it's Palo Alto. And one day, across the street, I noticed a for sale sign hanging on a fence. Now, there wasn't much behind that fence, maybe a quarter acre plot, if that, whose most notable feature was a fixer-upper house that really looked more like a shack and would most certainly be a teardown. Plus, there was the yellow grass parched from California's endless droughts. So that was across the street from the house that my brother rents. And I was fascinated by this plot because asking price for this unremarkable corner of the California dream? Several million dollars. Okay, but I hear you saying all over again, it's Palo Alto, home of billionaire tech bros, Stanford University, and therefore a veritable carnival of American inequality, and you are right. So instead, let's listen to other folks in the Golden State. Just how bad is the state of housing in the state of California?
Hi, my name is Bonnie Moore, and I live in Santa Cruz, California. My mortgage payment is $2,500 a month. I have a $900 a month tax bill, and I am retired and 72 years old, and this is not working, not financially or economically.
Hi, my name is Katie. I live in Ventura, California. I'm 38, and I've been here for 6 years. The only reason I was able to squeak into buying a house here is because I previously lived in a low-cost-of-living city, Columbus, Ohio, and I owned a home there that appreciated significantly in my last 2 years of living there. I see people my age paying thousands each month for student loans, rent, daycare, and other necessities, and there's no way for them to save the $160,000 that now constitutes a 20% down payment in this area. According to Best Places, the cost of a home in my zip code has gone up 40% in the last 5 years and 86% in the last 10 years.
Hi, my name is Mark Massoud. I'm a professor at UC Santa Cruz and the University of California. And this campus, UC Santa Cruz, provides workforce housing because of the high price of housing in California. So we are able to purchase a home, get our mortgage through the university at a lower interest rate, and then we sell it back to the university if we ever leave. And that allows us to afford housing. I can't afford housing on the open market.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. California is desperately seeking solutions to its ongoing housing crisis. So last month, the state passed two bills, and Governor Gavin Newsom signed them, SB 9 and SB 10. And those bills would allow multiple housing units on qualified land previously zoned for single-family housing. Now, zoning is one of the most important and powerful forms of local control, so it is remarkable that the state has stepped into making this change. But will it make a difference? Will it ease housing costs in California? And what are the potential downsides? Now, these are all questions worth answering because, as we know, often California serves as a testing ground, a model for ideas that could spread across the country. So let's dig in. We're joined by Ben Metcalf. He's managing director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley. And he joins us from Berkeley, California. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Happy to be here.
So first of all, before we get to the nitty-gritty, I'm curious, has the California housing crisis, that $800,000 median house price, has it had an impact on your life?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. We have struggled to keep our friends and family in the community. We've watched people move out. as they have friends who have realized that they can't buy a home, looking to other regions, to other parts of the country, other parts of the state. So yeah, most recently it's been this sort of exodus of people looking for a better opportunity where they can afford the housing.
Wow. Okay. So then tell me, first of all, what is in, more specifically, SB 9 and SB 10? What are the key changes that the bills make?
Yeah, they're actually the culmination, I think, of what we've seen over just the last couple of years of a real relook at our single family zoned neighborhoods in California. Single-family zone neighborhoods are a big chunk of the residential land. It's about two-thirds of all residential land has that single-family zoning restriction on it. And historically, it's been the one part of our residential lands that really hasn't seen new construction. We've seen big subdivisions going up on greenfields. We've seen denser apartment buildings and housing going up on our inner core, but the single-family neighborhoods have remained relatively static. Starting a couple of years ago, that began to change with accessory dwelling unit laws mm-hmm. that passed in California that allowed homeowners to attach rental units to their homes. And then over the last couple of years, we started to see cities in California, Sacramento, San Jose, San Diego, beginning to push farther to sort of say, well, if a single rental unit makes sense, maybe really allowing for a full subdivision of that single family parcel makes even more sense. And that culminated with SB 9, which allows really any homeowner in California to be able to effectuate the subdivision of his or her parcel or the split of his or her home to create up to four units. SB 10 is a parallel bill to that, which allows local governments to much more easily create new zoning designations that allow for up to 10 units. It bypasses a lot of the bureaucratic rules and restrictions that had gotten in the way of local governments who wanted to move in this direction.
Okay. So for SB 9 specifically, though, then, just to be clear, any individual homeowner anywhere in the state could say, well, I want to turn my current home into, like you said, up to four units or split the land that my home sits on and build, another unit on the other half of the property?
Yeah, it doesn't apply. There are certainly going to, so a couple things. First of all, there are some exclusions in the bill. So the bill does allow for local governments to prevent this from happening where there will be significant health and safety impacts. So think, for example, of homes located in high fire zone, extremely high fire risk areas, that they may be limited in those examples. And then, of course, some homeowners may find that they literally don't have space on their parcels. I mean, if you don't have a backyard, that makes it very hard to create a cottage in your backyard. Mm-hmm. So there may also be some spatial limitations. But the analysis that we did over the summer suggested that far and away, for most homeowners in California, there will be the sort of physical capacity and legal capacity to make that split happen.
Wow, if they wanted to. Okay. And so therefore through this law, they would no longer have to go to their local municipality for some kind of special exemption to do that?
Yeah, so in California there's a sort of a two-step process to create new housing. The first is you have to have what's called a planning approval. You have to have you have to either confirm that what you want to do conforms with the local zoning or get a special exemption from your planning commission or city council. What the state did is basically take that off the table. So now you still have to get that approval, but it's perfunctory. The city basically has to give it to you. It has to be ministerial. So it has to be done by a staff person. It doesn't go to a city council vote. There's no discretion. The city has to give you that permission. There's a second step, of course, which is you still have to be compliant with the building code. You still mm-hmm. have to work with the building department. You know, it still has to be a safe structure that's built according to the specifications of the city. But the cities are really limited going forward to objective standards that have to be written down and be fully transparent.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, I mean, it's clear that this really strikes at the heart of local control over at least this aspect of zoning. That's a big deal in and of itself. And we're going to hear from a California mayor in a little bit about from the local perspective. But approximately how many additional housing units could SB 9 and SB 10 over time create? What's the hope here? And how much does that actually make a difference in terms of the housing crisis in California?
Yeah. So there are about 7.5 million single family parcels in the state of California. our estimate was that about 6 million of them, so again, a large majority, would be eligible. The question then becomes, well, where do the economics make sense? Where would it really be a decent return for a homeowner to actually add this? Where would the rent that you would get or the sales price that you would get actually offset the cost of construction? And that calculation drops down quite a bit. There are many places that just won't make economic sense to proceed forward. But when we paired this SB9 with the state's pre-existing accessory dwelling unit laws, we found that approximately 2.5 million new units would be both possible to build in terms of the space and economically feasible to build. SB9 is a portion of that. So it's about, our estimate is about 700,000 of that 2.5 million new units. And so how do you put that into scale? What does that mean? Well, one way to think about that is the state of California as a whole is only building about 100,000 new homes every year. So the passage of SB9 paired with what we've put in place with these ADU laws opens up about 25 years worth of new inventory. I think the huge question is uptake. Mm-hmm. And how many homeowners actually want to build, it makes sense. And how long will it take, given the kind of capacity we have in the state? There's a finite number of builders. There's a finite number of folks at any point in time who want to do these changes. So I think there's a huge potential here. For me, it's really more of a, how long is this going to actually take to be able to get to scale?
Right. Well, I'm seeing that Dan Dunmoyer, president and CEO of the California Building Industry Association, he's been quoted as saying, we're not going to build like 500,000 homes in the next year. He said, we're still going to build 100,000. And that even 80,000 more than that would be needed to just break even. But he doesn't actually see production increasing enormously anytime soon. So we have a lot more to explore on this bold move from the state of California to change local zoning laws to basically create more space to build more housing, ideally, to relax the housing crisis there. We'll have more about the impacts of this idea when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about California's bold move, the state essentially getting into the game of local zoning in order to create more opportunities to build more housing to at least begin to relax the state's housing crisis. And I'm joined today by Ben Metcalf. He's managing director of the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley. And Ben, if you can just hang on here for a second, I'd like to introduce a couple of more people into the conversation. Adam Fowler joins us from Los Angeles. He's director of research at Beacon Economics and the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. Adam Fowler, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
And Victor Gordo joins us as well. He is the mayor of Pasadena, California. Mayor Gordo, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, Adam Fowler, let me ask you, if I understand correctly, sort of similar type bills, or actually I should say even more ambitious bills, failed in California over the previous 3 years. So what was significantly different now such that the bills made it to Governor Gavin Newsom's desk and he signed them? Was he just feeling especially confident after surviving the recall?
That may be the case. I think there's been a lot of coalition building. These are very complicated, often very unique city by city questions. When you get into zoning, when you get into kind of all the individual policies that local jurisdictions have in this space, economists, academics, it's oftentimes hard to kind of aggregate up and roll out rules of thumb in order to understand these policies. So I think it's been a lot of hard work by a lot of different groups coming together to articulate kind of the wonky nuances that are really at the heart of the problem. I think the other thing that I'm excited about, and I think liberals have, you know, since the Reagan years, been a little nervous when it comes to the word supply. And I think finally, on so many issues, we often, it's a lot easier to address the demand side, right? Like, let's throw some money at things like food stamps or housing vouchers, or let's mandate inclusionary housing policies to try to address the demand side. But even with like rent control is another example. But what we've not had much traction doing is trying to pair those with solutions around supply constraints. And that, I think, is finally the shift we're seeing as evidenced by these two bills.
Okay. So I want to get your expertise, Ben's expertise as well, but then integrate it into the on-the-ground reality in Pasadena. So Mayor Gordo, I just did some quick looking at the sort of state of housing in Pasadena, and I see that last year, at the end of last year, for the first time ever, the median home price in Pasadena passed $1 million. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So how would you describe sort of the state of housing in Pasadena, and is it meeting the needs of the people there?
You know, the state of housing in Pasadena, much like every other community, you know, there's no question there's a supply issue in Pasadena, as there is across the state of California. And that has caused and had an impact on prices. I think we should take a step back and recognize the state's role in creating that crisis. You know, when the state of California took redevelopment dollars away from municipalities and counties throughout the state of California, it had a tremendous impact on our ability to increase supply in Pasadena and beyond in other municipalities. And so we are very concerned, but we don't believe that a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter approach imposed on Pasadena and the rest of the state of California is going to be the solution. In fact, I believe that plot, Meghna, that you were talking about in Palo Alto, will multiply what we are anticipating and what we're beginning to see in Pasadena is land speculation. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you take a single family residential lot that contains one house and you're able to split it and develop it into up to, you know, 8 units. That lot becomes much more valuable. And after a few years can be sold at a tremendous profit. Yeah.
Well, Mayor Gordo, if I just might step in here for a second, I have to admit I live in a terribly expensive housing market as well, being here in eastern Massachusetts. And I'm very familiar with what you're saying, because not far from our studios here at On Point, something similar goes on. And it may not be individual owners who want to put another unit on their land or convert their own home. But when those owners sell, frequently, what we see is developers buying it, right? And they can buy it all cash and at a higher price. And then they will indeed do exactly what you said. They will put, I don't know, I've seen 4, 6, 8, 13, even 20 units going on a plot of land that used to have one old home on it. On the one hand, it does create more housing. But on the other hand, and let me turn back to Ben Metcalf on this, and then I'll get your local take there, Mayor Gordo. But Mr. Metcalf, how can we guarantee that the housing that is created is affordable? Right? That's the question, because I think what we see a lot are, I mean, you heard from the construction group earlier, like there has to be a certain amount of money that they make in order to build. And oftentimes they make that money through high income housing.
Yeah, so this is the crux of the challenge we face, is that we have spent a lot of time in states like California, Massachusetts too, really making it hard to build new homes. I mean, this goes back decades, and it's not just a zoning issue. Although zoning is a big part of it, it's also just the discretion that comes in approving projects. It's a layering complexity to the building code. And so the consequence of all this is it just has made it very hard for private sector actors to add adequate housing to keep up with sort of the natural growth that happens in communities like Massachusetts and California to facilitate immigration of people who want to access jobs that offer upward economic mobility. We've been in a multi-decade long sort of building slump. And I think one solution could be to sort of say, well, we need to bring in government subsidy to directly address this. The problem is that you end up chasing your tail a little bit. If there's a finite number of homes and you're trying to subsidize certain people to access those homes, the increased demand over time will just make those prices and rents continue to go up. But the root cause solution really is to try and figure out how we can get more housing getting built in the communities where we want them to get built. And that is a place where, you know, I do think there is a logic in having professionalized builders and developers helping to do that work. As a homeowner, trying to add units can be very, very time consuming, exhausting, complicating, and confusing. And so having folks who can come in and help take underutilized land, underutilized homes, add units, facilitate the conversion of them to multi-unit structures is actually really fundamentally needed and helpful as we try and just get more housing out there so people have more housing options. If you have multi-unit structures in quantity, house prices will stabilize. If you have smaller units that often come with multi-unit structures, you also have naturally more affordable housing. I mean, just think about a 800 square foot apartment side by side with a 3,000 square foot home. The one is going to cost much less than the other. It will offer less space, but it will still be naturally more affordable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Adam Fowler, I think what I'm trying to wrap my head around here is, and again, let's just use Pasadena as an example. As Mayor Gordo told us, yes, in December of 2020, the median house price, the median home price in Pasadena went north of $1 million. And I'm also looking at the median household income. This is census data from in 2019 dollars in Pasadena. It's just $83,000. There's a fundamental gap there between what people can afford and what is out there on the market. What I'm curious is how much might these new, this sort of change in zoning, the state-mandated change in zoning, really, honestly, do? How much will it do to shrink that gap?
Well, I think over the longer time horizon, it's going to be very important. We didn't wring our hands quite as much around the ADU bill a while back, and that's doing a lot of work as well. I mean, the headlines weren't quite as hysterical in terms of the end of something we hold dear. But as Ben was mentioning in his analysis, those ADUs are doing a lot of the work as well. I think a couple things come to mind. We muddled this conversation a little bit when we talk about things like workforce housing or capital A affordable housing, or we try to dance around some of these questions by labeling things in such a way where we can get everybody to kind of agree that, yes, on its face, that's something we value. I think what concerns us from an economics point of view is the kind of lost opportunity for growth. Estimates range from 2 upwards to 9% of GDP that's kind of artificially constrained by our somewhat dysfunctional housing regulatory infrastructure. And you think about all of the investments, the world-class investments California has made over the years, and housing's role in limiting access. Mm-hmm. So when we invest in multi-billion dollar metro, train, rail, et cetera, in Los Angeles, when we invest in arts and culture, when we invest in our universities, our schools. At the top of the show, you talked about a professor at UC Santa Cruz.
Yep.
We see it at UC Santa Barbara. We are artificially limiting those opportunities when people can't find housing, when it's so tough to be able to access those. And so I think we've got to really think about the things we pride ourselves in, those investments that do make differences in people's lives over the long term, we're closing off the opportunity artificially. And that just constrains kind of productivity, innovation, economic growth over the long run.
Okay. So, Mayor Gordo, let me turn back to you here, because I think there's some really important points that have been made, and I want to definitely hear your response. You heard Adam Fowler talking about an artificial constraint, essentially, on opportunity in California. And also he said, you know, there's been a lot of wringing of hands about the end, quote, the end of something we hold dear because of SB 9 and SB 10. How do you respond to that as mayor of Pasadena?
I do. Well, you know, I would say to you that, you know, these there has been, in fact, artificial limitations, but it's been on wages. You know, the same people who make the argument that this is going to solve the housing crisis will then say to you that, you know, we shouldn't focus on raising the wages. You're absolutely correct. You know, the wage disparity and the lack of increases on the wage side has caused people to not be able to keep up with and afford housing. You know, these plans like SB 9 presuppose that the housing that's added in single family residential neighborhoods, you know, taking one property and constructing eight with the eight combining it with the ADU, is going to be constructed by good actors, that they're not going to take advantage of the market in Pasadena and suddenly, you know, they're going to sell them at an affordable rate. I believe that the opposite is true, that plot you were focused on in Palo Alto, that's very expensive, is going to be replicated in Pasadena, and particularly in neighborhoods that at the moment aren't as expensive and can be picked up cheaply, you know, relatively speaking, split and then redeveloped and resold individually at market rate. There's no, absolutely right. No guarantee that they'll go for anywhere under the market rate.
And, you know, Mayor Gordo, look, I know that it's not really kosher for a journalist to bring in their own personal experience. It's just that, like, I'm living in a community that totally mirrors what's happening in California. And I can tell you, developers understandably have a required rate of return on their investment. And because of that, they will not sell. They will not create units that are quote unquote or capital A affordable, as Adam Fowler said, unless they are required to by the state or municipality. That's another discussion here. But let me ask you something, Mayor Gordo. This wringing of hands description that Adam Fowler offered us here, I can hear how some of that is happening, but do you think that you're wringing your hands for a reason? Because again, I'll use my local municipality here as an example. With the increase in housing, mostly through these multi-family units that have come up in my neighborhood, the school district, for example, locally here, over the course of roughly 7-ish years, underwent a 30% enrollment increase, 30% where I live. Now, on the one hand, that's great. People want to live in my town and the schools are great. But on the other hand, it just really laid bare the ancillary cost to increasing housing, because housing isn't infrastructure that's in isolation, right? There are schools, there's transportation, there's, you know, shopping centers, there's the increased cost of the schools when you have more kids come in, which again is great. But what I'm wondering is, as a mayor, are the systems in place, do you think, to absorb that growth and help the community grow better overall?
Well, that's a very insightful and very good question, Raina. Thank you. You know, and that's part of the problem. You know, in Pasadena, we were the first in the region to adopt an inclusionary housing ordinance, mandating 20% of all housing be constructed affordable, mandating, not hoping. And, you know, we were moving forward with an accessory dwelling unit plan and had adopted and allowed for accessory dwelling units for homeowners to construct. But we were doing it in conjunction with or concurrent with looking at the infrastructure, and not just the built infrastructure, roads, schools, and capacity of for water, electricity, all of those things, but the social infrastructure, policing, fire. Do we have the services that we need if SB9 is successful? And all of these units are constructed. One, they have a tremendous impact on the quality of life in residential neighborhoods. In fact, they're targeted to residential neighborhoods. And two, there will be an impact on the built and social infrastructure. And none of that is measured in SB9 and its related bills.
Well,
and that's the problem.
Mayor Victor Gordo and Ben Metcalf and Adam Fowler, I'm definitely going to want to get your response to that when we come back. Just taking a quick break here. And as this hour, we're taking a look at some really significant bills that have been recently passed in California to try to do something meaningful to relax, at least a little, California's housing crisis and what lessons the rest of the country can learn from what's happening in California. So we'll come back with more. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about some bold moves that the state of California has made and two bills that Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed to try to relax a little bit, at least, of California's ongoing housing crisis. And how much of a crisis is it in the state of California? Well, according to one estimate, somewhere between 2 and 3.5 million housing units are needed in California to meet the state's housing shortage, 2 to 3.5 million units. So these two new bills, SB 9 and SB 10, I should actually call them laws now since they've been signed, by one estimate from the Turner Center for Housing and Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley, we could see something like 600,000 new housing units being built across California over the next several years. Ben Metcalf joins me. He's managing director at the Turner Center, and he's with us from Berkeley, California. Victor Gordo joins us. He is the mayor of Pasadena, California. And Adam Fowler's with us as well. He's director of research at Beacon Economics and the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. So, Ben Metcalf, let me just quickly hear from both you and Adam about Mayor Gordo's concern about the sort of knock-on impacts locally with an increase in housing construction. And let me actually just read for a quick second, if I could, from a letter or an opinion note that he wrote that he recently co-signed here. And it says, SB 9 would effectively abolish backyards by allowing rear setbacks of no more than 4 feet, depriving children of a safe place to play and residential neighborhoods of green space, privacy, light, and fresh air. And then increasing residential density could result in unplanned and unsustainable impacts on local public safety, schools, parks, traffic, parking, sewers, drinking water, energy grids, and other vital neighborhood services and infrastructure. So it's more than just sort of a loss of the suburban backyard he's talking about here. Your response to that, Ben?
Look, absolutely. Cities need to plan for growth. We are not cast in our California communities cannot be cast in amber. They cannot be communities of exclusion. They need to be places where kids can grow up and stay where aspiring entrepreneurs, immigrants, lower-income individuals can move in, get jobs, and move up and, you know, pursue the American dream. I think that framing of the question really misses the bigger sort of historical lens, which is not like what's the challenge that's going to come from unwinding single family, but what are the cascading set of social harms and public costs that have accumulated over the decades where we have had single family zoning in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, recall single family zoning is a relatively recent construction. It really in most California cities only emerged in the middle of the 20th century. Berkeley was actually one of the originators of it, has a dubious distinction of passing one of the first single family zoning ordinances in 2016. It was motivated. I mean, the record is very clear that it was motivated by a desire of individuals who wanted to preserve and protect the status quo. They viewed this single family zoning through a racial lens of wanting to exclude non-white individuals and to preserve and protect their property values. What has happened over a century of locking in single family zoning has been that this growth has been pushed either to our exurban periphery in ways that are very, very negative for climate change goals, or they've caused overcrowding. Families doubled up in ways that are not healthy, that are put them at fire risk, that still have a burden on the public sector, that pushed them out of the community altogether and prevented them from being able to access that, again, those kinds of jobs, the higher quality education, the better amenities that are found in suburban communities. So I think we have to put it in that light. How can we unwind the harm that has happened by not allowing a reasonable level of density in these homes? And I think there is, this is not, these are choices that we are basically giving back to homeowners in these communities to basically say, you have an ability with the land that you control to make certain basic decisions about it that can lead to the creation of new homes. These new homes will tend to be smaller than the homes that exist on these lots. These are coming about primarily through the subdivisions of existing homes. Those smaller homes do mean naturally more affordable price points than you get with the market. So I think you have to see it in that light. Yes, there's challenges with growth, but I think we have to face those challenges going forward because in some sense we have to remedy the public policy mistakes of the past.
Well, Ben Metcalf, Managing Director of the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Adam Fowler, I understand, though, that there are some communities and some sort of housing groups that are actually who are in lower income or communities of color, and they're actually somewhat concerned that developers could take advantage of the opening up or the possibility of going into sort of lower cost neighborhoods, building more housing there and essentially flipping the available land. And that could actually have a negative impact on those communities themselves by, in other words, long story short, accelerating gentrification there. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think those concerns are valid. I think I think about these questions as the status quo now. So Ben talked about overcrowding. That's very real. California stands out on just any metric you want to look at: housing units per capita, vacancy rates, overcrowding. Like, the status quo is these folks are here. If we take a world in where we're not bringing in new people that don't look like us, like, a lot of this is demand that already exists. So we see just time and time again, I laugh. And when I think about research that's often done on unpermitted units, for example, you know, Los Angeles, folks have been finding creative ways off the grid to turn a garage into a housing unit, sheds, doing all kinds of weird, quirky things. 300,000 of those estimated in Los Angeles alone. So, like, you know, the neighborhood traffic, there's a lot of that baked in already. And I think thinking that somehow the status quo is going to be radically altered across all these dimensions, a lot of it's already happening. We just don't see it as clearly in the data. With regard to the gentrification, I'm always a little cautious because these are still market decisions. I don't have a value judgment. If a family in a community of color, if the market gives them an opportunity, I trust their decision. If taking a giant bag of cash because that's where the market is and deciding to move somewhere else. I'm not going to judge that family for doing that. I think, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is allowing market transactions to happen. And a regulated market is often really quite helpful in a lot of these questions. And we've had a regulatory infrastructure that's kept a lot of the normal market signals from taking place. The final thing I would say is 90% of low-income households in California live in market-rate homes. Hmm. There's not enough Capital A affordable. There's not enough Section 8. Like, we all pat ourselves on the back when we say we want affordable. We want to do an inclusionary policy. Inclusionary units, do you know how they come online? They come online when market rate is built. Like the inclusionary, I'm going to set aside 20%. You have to get the first thing done first. The market rate has to happen. And when you look at a lot of these communities that have these inclusionary, I applaud them. But then at the end of the day, you say, well, what actually got built and what percentage of those beds actually came online? And often it's very disappointing because the market rate is constrained and you don't get the downstream impacts of inclusionary units coming online.
Yeah, point totally taken. But then to my mind, it's effectively no difference between requiring it and not requiring it, because if you didn't, the market would provide zero of those sort of units that would be more accessible to people at lower incomes. But Mayor Victor Gordo, let me turn back to you here. Adam Fowler's argument about the market actually serves a very powerful purpose here is I take note of that. But then would you rely on the market, Mayor Gordo, to provide the resources and funding to support the additional needs that you talk about in that letter that you co-signed for public safety, for schools, for parks, to manage increased traffic in Pasadena if there's a significant growth in the amount of available housing?
Well, then we're right back where we started. Then we're driving up the cost of construction and driving up the cost of affordability, you know, in Pasadena. And look, I believe that Pasadena has and is doing its part to create more affordable housing through inclusionary housing, through incentives and ADUs. At the moment, we have in the pipeline 1,021 units that are going to be constructed at an affordable rate. When you compare that to what SB 9 is projected to do in Pasadena, blowing up single family residential neighborhoods, it's about 2,000 additional units. And so it's not necessarily the number of units, but the impact to the cost of units, because it's not going to be homeowners. It's going to be land speculators. It's going to be developers. And they're going to turn single-family residential neighborhoods into a land grab opportunity that does trigger gentrification, that does precisely the opposite of what proponents of SB 9 have said it will do. It's going to increase the cost. This is not unlike the TOD, the transit-oriented development, high-density development that the state pushed on cities throughout California. We were told it will improve affordability. If you increase high density development, it will improve sustainability. And I've not seen either one of those occur. Hmm. Developers use the higher density along TODs to construct very, very expensive housing that in Pasadena rents from between $3,000 and $5,000 for a one or two bedroom apartment. Hmm. That is not affordable, but yeah, developers made quite a bit of profit.
So Mayor Gordo and Adam Fowler are here. We've got 5 minutes left, and I want to turn to sort of what's next or what should come next here. In order to do that, actually, let's just listen to what's been happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, because like California, but a little bit earlier, the city of Minneapolis implemented a decade-long plan to help ease its housing squeeze, and they implemented that beginning last year. Jana Flissrand is co-founder of Neighbors for More Neighbors, an abundant and affordable housing advocacy group that pushed for the plan.
There's not going to be a single giant rewrite of this 1,000-page zoning code that we have here in Minneapolis. One of the first was to give people the option to build duplexes or triplexes on any lot in the city of Minneapolis.
Okay, well, thus far, only 88 units have been added to Minneapolis through this past August as a result of the new plan. But it's really not that much time. And city planner Alex Schieferdecker says that's to be expected.
The first thing to say is that it wasn't surprising. One of the big reasons simply is that these kind of things take some time to get going. You need a developer who says, there's a real market here. I want this to be my market.
And Schieferdecker says developers didn't have that particular confidence that building multiplexes would be worth the investment until the recent legal changes confirmed that such a market would exist. So it's hard, though, to know what exactly is going to happen in Minneapolis in the future. But Flissrand says flipping single-family zoned plots into multiplexes is just the starting point to fixing Minneapolis's housing crisis.
I would love to see Minneapolis do something where the city would create or support some pre-approved plans that might even have expedited approvals or reduced fees for triplexes that are allowed in Minneapolis, and that if somebody is going to build this, the city has already done the work of making sure that it meets all the rules and that it's something you can build and maybe meets other policies that we have in the city, like being very energy and water efficient. We need to think about how do we make it easy for people to build the kind of things that we want and need in our city.
So that's the view from Minneapolis, which not that long ago undertook a similar effort as we see recently in California. So we just got about 2 minutes left here. Adam Fowler, first to you, what are some of the other things that are needed to build the things that California requires to ease its housing crisis?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, as long as there's economic opportunity and growth in California, this is going to be an ongoing challenge. You know, when we tout our job numbers, when we tout our industries that are leading the globe, those jobs need beds at the end of the day. And so the status quo doesn't allow a lot of flexibility, right? So as market conditions change, as preferences, desires, the nature of what a family looks like changes, we need to allow some flexibility for homeowners to make decisions on what they can do with their land. Could you imagine if we told car manufacturers, here is what a car looks like? My grandfather drove a boat of a Cutlass Buick or Cutlass Spring. I mean, you know, the market right now wouldn't be for that thing. And so, you know, we see changes in household formation, birth rates. Folks need some opportunities. Right now we have in our rigid single family housing, we've historically just had a one size fits all solution. Mm-hmm. You had to pay for a parking spot. You had to have a yard. You had to have these things. Like in other parts of our market system, we like to give people choices. Maybe you want to live in a micro unit. Maybe you don't need a yard. And so I think that is one of the big opportunities that's presented.
Okay. You know, it's amazing to me that we got this far in the conversation and parking only just came up as a big part of the story. But Mayor Gordo, we've got about 30 seconds left. And I want to give you the last word here. SB 9 and SB 10 have passed. They are signed. So from your perspective as a mayor, though, what do you need now? What are the next steps that you think ought to be taken for housing to become more available and more affordable while also being mindful of the broader effects in a place like Pasadena?
Well, I do think that assisting homeowners with issues like development and design and having the city do some of the work in advance to construct ADUs is a smart way. We are doing that in Pasadena. And I think that the state should focus on cities like choosing to do the right thing through inclusionary housing and other means and incentives to construct responsible housing and affordable housing, increasing and mandate that other cities do the same thing.
Well, Victor Gordo, mayor of Pasadena, California, thank you so much for joining us today. And Adam Fowler, director of research at Beacon Economics, with us from Los Angeles, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.